The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening, everyone, and welcome to IMC. Thank you for meditating here, meditating in community. I always think it's a contribution everyone makes to each other to meditate together. For many people, the motivation to keep meditating for time, for years, comes partly from knowing that other people do it and meditating with other people and being supported and knowing other people do it so that you're not the only one who's weird. Or so it doesn't seem so strange. For some people, in their worlds that they live in, places of work or something like that, meditation can seem quite strange. And some people can feel lonely or a little bit awkward, even mentioning that they do it. So thank you for coming here. And I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to say today, but I'm inspired to say something from a frequent experience I have when I sit down to meditate. And that is that I'll sit down and close my eyes, and as soon as I close my eyes, the external world kind of recedes pretty quickly, and the world that is vibrant or alive or present could be called this internal world, the world that I can have direct experience of and feel, sense. And I've been meditating for a long time, and partly the fruit of that is that when I sit down, it's a delightful place inside. That I sit down and the inside is just like a treasure house sometimes I feel like I've come home, but that's probably saying it too mildly, that it feels like a treasure or a garden that's abundant with all kinds of wonderful flowers or something. And that the feeling of goodness, the feeling of happiness or well-being or safety or all these things that I feel, there's very few things that the world has to promise that, two things that probably are as good, or if they are as good, aren't as cheap. Unless 45 years of work is, you know, considered expensive. Whatever happiness I saw, we get these advertisements, probably you do too, at home in the mail. I don't know why they keep trying. the back of this one had to do about winning a $50,000 Jaguar. And I looked at that. What a headache. If I won this Jaguar, you know, what would I do with it? You know, we don't even have a garage. Street parking's what we have. What are the maintenance costs? Just getting the oil changed in that. I don't know if I could even afford, you know. Just like what would I do with this? You know, that's not going to make me happy. I thought for one moment, well, maybe I'll go test drive it before I refuse it. Because it might be kind of fun to try zipping around. But maybe. But I'm pretty confident that I would not have the same pleasure, joy, delight as I have when I sit down and close my eyes, see what's inside. I'm aware of all these years I've practiced. I know that it was not always the case this way. that when I started meditating, there was lots of turmoil. There was lots of suffering. There was lots of difficult memories, experience of life that I had to work my way through. I remember my body was not a place of delight and wonder and home. And the body didn't feel like a treasure house. The body was on fire. Tremendous amount of pain, and knots, and tensions, and things that were there. And I felt quite a fortunate, looking back, I feel fortunate that in my early years, in the 1970s, when I started meditating, I was practicing in Zen, which back then, and you know, historically, is in some ways psychologically unsophisticated, in the sense that there's not a lot of psychological understanding about how the mind works, and a lot of the psychological sophistication of India, Buddhist India, was kind of dropped. In Zen and Mahayana, for in favor of a very direct experience of awakening, of presence, or something. And certainly there were not a lot of teachings about this, what was going on internally, emotions and feelings, and how to be with thoughts, or how to be with my suffering and my psychological pain. And also, probably for me, because I'm kind of odd, it was a time that when I was learning all this in the 1970s, there was, you know, a fair amount of psychological sophistication. But we know so much more now than we did in the 1970s about psychology and how the mind works. And I'm so glad I didn't know it. Because for me, how it worked for me was I didn't know enough to make a big deal out of it. I didn't know enough to try to fix it or make it go away. I didn't know enough to kind of define myself by it or take it as a personal failing, or I was kind of naive. And sometimes it's pretty good to be naive if you're going to start the meditation path, because it allowed me to suffer in an uncomplicated way. It allowed me to kind of not try to deal with it or focus on it singularly or get too alarmed by it or think it was too big of a deal or have all kinds of ideas of what's supposed to happen or who's supposed to do what or something. And certainly the sophistication and what we know now has been so important for our society and for many, many individuals. And I'm very glad that we've come to where we are now and we know a lot more about trauma and all kinds of issues. So I'm not putting that down, but it was very, looking back for me in my particular path, I think it was really important for me to not know so much and just to be able to keep showing up, keep being present for my experience, which was a lot of suffering, without knowing I was supposed to do anything about it, without trying to, you know, fix it or get away from it or make it better or something. I just suffered simply. And because of that, I think it began to dissolve or unfold. And one of the remarkable things that happened in all that was that because I suffered so much and so much pain, physical pain and emotional pain, I became compassionate. That somehow, because I wasn't fighting it, I was just trying to be present for it, something began shifting inside, and I started feeling more and more, this kind of compassion grew. I didn't really care about compassion. I mean, I remember I was pretty naive, and so I wasn't looking for compassion, or I didn't even think it was that important. But lo and behold, if you have simple presence, at least for me, with this suffering, something got tenderized and softened, and something got awakened, some kind of ability to be present and be soft with it. And that softness, something began shifting and changing. And this idea of having this compassion awaken in me was probably, you know, becoming compassionate maybe is more important for some of us than becoming enlightened. And so this compassion kind of came. And all these kinks that I had in my mind and my heart, all these knots, slowly, you know, to work with them and see them and work through them and make space for them and let them resolve themselves. And things started to settle away and settle away and fall away. Ran into great abysses of fear in the process of things falling away. And at some point seeing some of the things I had to let go of, seeing that some of the tendency of my mind, some of the conceit I had, some of the attachments I had to certain kind of forms of identity were not serving me, were not even true. Some of the social games I played to try to get people to think I was great or to like me just seemed to be overrated. But I had a strong instinct, you know, this drive or this fear not to do that. And it was a big deal to sit there at the abyss and watch that and be with it. And then to finally see that drop away. And that the abyss didn't kill me. It was okay. It was an amazing experience. And slowly, this idea that the inner life is a place of delight, a place of comfort. It's good in there. It's like, you know, what goes on inside of me is my best friend. You know, I like being there. I like it that the mind gets quiet. I mean, some of the surface chatter of the mind that we can have is worrying about things. And so not having to worry, you know, not really sit down here with you today. And I didn't have anything really I had to worry about beyond, you know, is this an in-breath or an out-breath? You know, it felt really nice not to have that and not have to kind of go up into this discursive mind that need to think about things and figure things out and tell stories. And to feel at ease and at rest, to this, you know, safe to not be spinning tales and stories and having conversations in my head. So this turning inward, one of the consequences of this in Buddhism is a deep appreciation for what's called karma. That, you know, a simple way of teaching karma is that what you do, the seeds you plant, has to do with the fruits that you harvest. And so if you plant seeds of greed, hate, and delusion, you harvest something that has some characteristics or some suffering that is related to greed, hate, and delusion as a fruit. If you plant seeds of generosity and love and kindness, that blossoms in some way. And some of the way the Buddhists will talk, they'll talk about merit, that you get merit, good merit and bad merit. But I don't know if that's the right translation into English of this ancient word. But there's a real understanding. I think that if you really kind of live in this interior life and start becoming wise and seeing how it works and seeing how the energies of your body move and inside and all that, you can start seeing directly that if you want to have a sense of treasure house within, if you want to have your inner life be a place that feels a place where it's your best friend or delightful or it's a good place to be, you have to tend. It's like a garden you have to tend. And if you plant noxious weeds in your garden, you get noxious weeds. Plant noxious seeds, you get noxious weeds. And if you plant stinging nettles, you know, watch out when you go, you know, you better wear gloves when you go into your garden. So what we do, what we think, what we say, what we do, what we live by inside, you can really feel how that's going to affect and what it's the inner garden. And you can feel how some weeds, some seeds, some weeds, some plants in there are not really, don't contribute to the beauty, don't contribute to, actually they contribute to the opposite. And some things that go on inside are worse than just creating noxious weeds. Some things inside just parch the soil. And the soil inside, in which things can grow, becomes hard-panned and parched and dry and cracked. But to be able to let the inner soil in which things can grow and develop be a rich soil and soft and moist and something that really allows things to grow, and then to grow the things that are really good and feel it inside, you know, this is actually good, this is supporting, this is nice, what's growing, what's developing. And so the interiority, this inner life. And some people will think these Buddhists are so self-centered or so, you know, shutting themselves off from the world. But remarkable things happens, I believe, at least in my vocabulary. I'll offer you in my vocabulary, maybe it doesn't really work, this way of talking doesn't evoke something for you. But as what I found is that as my inner life became more harmonious, nicer, softer, freer, a wonderful place to be, that it became at some point like this interiority, this going in like this, was that I got turned inside out. And it's kind of like, you know, if you go around, you know, your hand, your soft, sensitive part of your hand is your palm. And if you have your hand in a fist all the time, you know, that soft, tender, sensitive palm is not available to the world. But imagine that somehow something happens that turned everything inside out, and that soft palm was available to the world, and the sensitivity and the warmth and different things that it has to offer then can be offered to the world. So the same way, go inward. We're not meant to stay there, you know, and cut off from the world, but it's a way of kind of being turned inside out and coming back into the world with a whole different heart, a whole different sensitivity, a whole different care, a whole different ability to, a whole different orientation of how we take in the experience of other people, the experience of suffering of the world, the joys of the world. It's a whole different way, because when it's in this being turned inside out this way happens, it's like we're less experiencing the world through the filter of our learned ideas, the concepts and ideas of what we've learned. I can learn about who's a Republican and Democrat, and I might have, you know, if that's the filter through which I see things, you know, I certainly limit the people I see to just being Republican or Democrat, but I might have opinions about that party. And then that affects how I see people. So that's all my ideas. It's kind of like on surface kind of ideas. But to drop the surface thoughts and ideas and be able to kind of turn inside out and experience people in some deeper way than the ideas of whatever it might be, and to be able to touch and experience people, feel people through the heart, prior to the ideas, prior to being Republican or Democrat or something else, I think is a profound way to experience the world. To be able to experience the world inside out, you can only be turned inside out this way if we don't cling, if we're not grasping or holding on tight to things. Many times when people are relating to the world and they haven't done the inside out movement and they think, well, I'm in the world, you know, that's where it's important, there's so much clinging, so much attachment. And, you know, and I've had people literally clutch my arm because there's someone way or the other they were attached to me. And it was like gripping so tight. And when I was younger, Or, you know, people have such attachment to a relationship being a certain way, or work being a certain way, or their jaguar being such a way. You know, that's, you know, all these things. And so we're exteriorly focused, but it's through the filter of our clingings and desires and our fears that go on. And it's kind of natural to do that. It's part of our, you know, efforts to become safe and secure, and often for good reason, because the world can be quite an unsafe place for many people. But to somehow have the ability to kind of put aside the world for a little while, and sit down and meditate, close your eyes, and eventually have this inside-out movement, we come back into the world a whole different way. And then to stay true to that, to stay connected to that is part of the art of how we live our life then. This idea of the interiority of our life being kind of where the center of Buddhism is a kind of an important point. And if there's a kind of a beginning of the Buddhist scriptures, it's the first two verses in the Dhammapada. And it's kind of remarkable what it says. And it's remarkable kind of, if this is the beginning of the Buddhist Bible, to compare it to the beginning of the Torah or the Old Testament, where the beginning has to do with God. And it depends what God is when you make the comparison, but still it's kind of points maybe to a different direction. So the beginning of the Buddhist scriptures goes something like this. It goes like this. All experience. And the word experience is a very important one. Experience has to do with how we perceive, how we live in the middle of our life and perceive it, take it in, how we experience it. It's not a statement about the world. It doesn't say everything in the world, reality. It doesn't start reality is. It starts something that's very personal, very direct and very immediate for each of us. Experience is something that happens in the present moment. So immediately, all experience, it's about your experience, what's happening to you now, how you're perceiving now, how you take in now. All experience, it's quite a beginning. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. So instead of God, we have mind as the beginning. The world of experience, the world that we experience, begins in the mind, led by mind, shaped by mind. And if the world out there maybe is, who knows where it comes from. But the world of experience is the world in which we take in the world, process it, cling to it, free ourselves from the clinging, get entangled with it, our insides get up entangled and knotted in it. And it's also the world in which we unravel the knots, where we release and resolve and dissolve what's there. And this has a lot to do with what goes on in our mind. And so Buddhism keeps pointing back into the mind. Look at that. Understand it. That's where your experience is, in a certain kind of way, in a very particular way, that's where your experience is born. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. I'm sure many of you are kind of already ready to debate this idea. I mean, how would that be? I mean, this... this wooden platform it was here before you showed up. your experience of the platform didn't, but your experience of the platform did not begin before you came. it occurred when you showed up. I heard a wonderful, I read a wonderful story recently. I heard it, wonderful little story. I never heard it before, but the person was a student of Ajahn Chah and told it like everyone knows it. So maybe you've heard the story. Ajahn Chah was a famous Thai meditation teacher who a lot of Westerners practiced with, Jack Kornfield and Ajahn Sumedho and many people. And he was often in alms rounds. Monks go out in the bowl and people, villagers will give them food for the day to eat. And he was leading a procession of his monks through the woods, the jungle. And they came across a very large boulder. And Ajahn Chah stopped and he pointed to the boulder and said to his monks, "Is that boulder heavy?" And his monk said, "Yeah, it's really heavy. It's a big boulder." And he said, "It's only heavy if you try to lift it." So that's a very interesting perspective. Now, you know, if you're scientifically inclined, you might say, wait a minute, the weight of it doesn't change. It's still heavy. The experience of heavy that you have only occurs if you lift it. What if you don't lift it? How many of your problems that you have exist because you're lifting it? I think someone said it was Mark Twain, but I don't know. I've had a lot of problems in my life, most of which never happened. And I know that's true for me. I mean, I have a tremendously poor track record in predicting what's going to happen in my life. And the number of times that I predicted disaster was so often, so many, that eventually, because I'm a slow learner, eventually I said, wait a minute, Gil. You keep predicting. It doesn't work out that way. And then I began, I started to doubt my predictions after a while of imminent disaster. And that helped me a little bit. I kind of let up and relaxed. So this idea of our experience, so then it goes on, the verse, all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows like the wheel, the hoof of the ox, the cart wheel, the hoof of the ox. So I think the image here is that poor ox is probably laboring under tremendous effort because the cart is heavy, and the experience of the ox is just hard to pull it. And so the wheel follows. So there, it's yoked together. There's a connected. The ox is tied to the cart, pulling it. So if you act and speak with a corrupted mind, you're creating the conditions inside of you where suffering follows. You're yoked to it. Then it goes to the second verse. First half is the same. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a pure mind. Is that what it says? Oh, no. Speak and act, I translate. speak and act with a peaceful mind. Then happiness follows like a never departing shadow. So here, shadow is a good thing. Shadow has no weight compared to the cart that the ox is pulling. Few of us are exhausted by the shadow that we're pulling along behind us as we walk through this, you know, an open sun or something. It doesn't interfere with anything. It doesn't bother us. It has no weight. It's light, but it's always with us. Imagine if your happiness was that way. It had no weight, no burden to have it. It doesn't tire you. But it never leaves you. It's always there. What a nice, I think it's a great image. So it gets a little bit more radical, this whole Buddhist stuff. The Buddhism, I think, has a very different orientation to our lives than most orientations, most worldviews, most philosophies have here in the West, I think. So it's a little bit outside of what people expect, maybe from religion. But you get a sense of this from another passage from the Buddha, where he talks about what the world is. And I talked about being turned inside out so we can experience the world, be connected to the world. But what are we really connected to when we're connected to the world? This quote from the Dhammapada, all experience is preceded by the mind. Our experience of the world also is somehow mediated by our mind's interpretation of it, our mind's processing of the mind's, you know, preferences around it, all kinds of things that the mind has some role, not the final role, but it has an important role. And so the Buddha defined the world. He said, what I call the world is this fathom-long body. So the world is this body. So that's a strange thing to say. But it's not so strange if you understand that it's through this, all the senses and the experience of the body that we mediate the world that we experience. It's almost like our senses have to be there first for us to have an experience of the world. Of course, the world's there before you were born, I think, before I was born. I suspect it was there before I was born. I wasn't there, but I've heard about it. And but my experience of the world is intimately, inseparably connected to how I sense it, feel it, experience it through the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, the body, and how the mind processes it, the ideas through which I interpret it, the concepts that I've culturally learned. These are important ways to see things or understand what's coming into my experience and the values I have, all kinds of things. And so this being turned inside out, the world out there is not so out there. The world in here is not so in here. Inside and outside don't really, at some point, there's not a hard and fast line between inside and outside. It's all here. It's all part and parcel of the same kind of field of experience or process of things coming and going. And even to reify, to coagulate around some notion of self, me, myself, and mine, is not really needed. It really kind of, it's kind of a stepping out. It's kind of losing something precious. And losing an intimacy, a connectivity, losing a capacity to really be wise and intelligent and sense and feel in some deeper, fuller way what's really happening here and going on here. So to do this interiority thing I talked about, of closing your eyes and really starting to tend to your inner garden, care for yourself, be your own best friend. If you can be your best friend for yourself with all your foibles, all your inner challenges that you have, try to be your friend for yourself. Be compassionate. Take your time. Don't jump into your deepest suffering and deepest challenge quickly, but to kind of befriend yourself and create the conditions where your inner life begins to feel like you are a friend. And if you're a friend for your interiority, whatever it's in there, it'll become your friend one day. And you'll really enjoy going there. And your inner life will really enjoy showing up for you. And if that deep friendship and care and for the inner life for oneself, this mutuality of inner and oneself, can transform itself into this turning inside out. And really to then have a capacity to feel or sense the world, the people of the world, experience what's happening in the world, all the suffering of the world, the challenges of the world. To experience it without the clinging or the anxiety or the despair or the discouragement that can come so easily when we haven't kind of discovered what this inner heart can, the freedom that this inner heart can have. And then to be animated by that compassion. And hopefully to have very little resistance to responding to what we see and what needs our attention in our world and what's important. And I certainly hope that this practice that we do, and I certainly hope that the teachings that I teach are not just for so people can be, you know, close their eyes and just feel like this is good in there and this is a garden, but that you create this beautiful garden inside and then realize the garden doesn't stop at the edges of your skin. The garden spreads out, and your garden is not just your inner garden. Your garden is the whole world. And it's up to you to take care of this world. And I think that's one, for me, that's one of the conclusions from this Buddhist idea that all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, and made by mind, is we stop living too excessively or too naively or something. It's their problem. They have to fix the world. They have to do it better. Of course they should. But so should you. And if you're kind of waiting for someone else to make the world a better place, but you're not doing it, even in small ways, then I don't think we've managed to do this being turned inside out. Then, if anything, if we do have a garden, maybe we're keeping it too much, our inner garden. But take down the walls. Turn yourself inside out. And understand that the garden you're tending is the whole world. That you are the world that way. All experience is your experience. So that's what I didn't know I was going to say. Inspired by sitting down and closing my eyes and appreciating this, how good it is in there. And I don't take that light, I don't take that for granted, I don't take that to be something that's easy to accomplish. I don't want to imply that it's something easy to experience. But I thought maybe it'd be okay to tell you that over these years of practice, that you know, these things are possible. And it's worthwhile. It's really worthwhile to be on this path, really worthwhile to do this work and discover and come to this place where all these different issues and ways of being are resolved and dealt with, and we're just kind of here and happy, peaceful. May that be your North Star as you go inwards and get turned inside out and go out. May you be a gift for this world. Okay? Thank you.